This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
All the people arguing that America is systemically racist, that law enforcement is corrupt, that black people get no justice in this country, got exactly what they were seeking on Wednesday when former police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of killing George Floyd. But all of these individuals were virtually unanimous in saying that this wasn't actually justice, that it doesn't change anything about the larger problems in America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, it's been a dramatic week in Minnesota. It started out with a protest every night. And over the weekend, over the killing of Dante Wright, and a lot of the, like, especially the Black Lives Matter groups involved in those protests were definitely sending a signal that, in addition to their stance on the Dante Wright case, that this rioting was going to continue and get much worse if they didn't get the verdict they wanted in the Derek Chauvin case, Derek Chauvin not being the victim, but the police officer in the George Floyd killing that happened also in the Minneapolis area last year. But as you mentioned, they did get what they wanted. They definitely made it clear that it was going to be bad if they didn't get what they wanted. I mean, you're looking at the conditions the jury was working under in that case, and one of their chief witnesses had a severed bloody pig's head show up on his step, and you had all these riots through it. So the jury was definitely made aware that they were going to be horrible riots in Minnesota and probably across the nation if they didn't rule that Derek Chauvin was guilty on all counts. But they did do that. They ruled he was guilty of second-degree manslaughter, third-degree murder, and second-degree murder. So I actually don't even know how it's possible to be simultaneously guilty of manslaughter and murder. It seems like those are normally something you have to choose one or the other. But just in case that they accused him of everything he was charged of, even if it was contradictory, to make sure that these riots didn't happen. And there isn't currently massive riots in the United States, but that doesn't mean that the people calling for the conviction are happy. There actually, I saw one clip from a journalist up there. I think Mr. Stephen Floyd played that on the Trumpet Daily yesterday, where journalist Ami Horowitz is interviewing protesters in Minneapolis, and one of them said that there shouldn't even be a trial. He should be convicted right now, just as he is. Another said that burn the whole city down. What does it even matter at this point? And then there was another that said, like, well, they said, I don't necessarily want a civil war, but if that's what it takes to get justice, that's what we'll have. So. And he's making the statement that, like, we might need a civil war in America after the police officer is convicted of all three counts of murder and manslaughter.
Yeah, and something else that was interesting about that is he asked, you know, how many black people do you think are being killed by police each year? And they said it must number in the thousands. And the actual number is fewer than 20. And this whole narrative that has been constructed here is based on this false idea of, you know, they're talking about there's absolutely genocide going on. And to see something like that, you really do have to recognize just how much culpability the media have in planting these ideas that are causing this kind of fear and anger in the minds of so many people.
Right. No, yeah, the media has tremendous power that way. It's kind of a similar phenomenon. Like, I've seen polls that, like, most Americans or a majority of Americans think that 20% of the country is homosexual when the real number is less than 4, just because of the amount of media coverage. You hear them talking all the time. You have the same thing here. It's like said, there's, less than 20 unarmed black people killed by police each year, but they get so much wall-to-wall media coverage whenever it happens that they don't tell you the statistics, which they don't, it's like I said, you've got big portions of the, or at least this radical segment of the population here in Minnesota that thinks that there's thousands of blacks being gunned down in the streets for doing nothing wrong, and that there's a genocide against them, and they need to protest for justice in America, when at the end of the day, you're looking at, like I said, less than 20 people, and in even of those 20, it's most of them are people like George Floyd, who was wrongfully killed while committing a crime and high on methamphetamines,
Resisting arrest.
So you can definitely say, like, if he wouldn't have resisted arrest, and he wouldn't have taken drugs, and he wouldn't have been passing counterfeit money, he'd have lived out his life in Minneapolis just fine, and no one would have bothered him. Hmm. But it definitely gives the politicians something to talk about as well. They had several cases. I think two of the more high profile ones were Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and former President Barack Obama coming out with their stance on this, with Keith Ellison saying that, "I would not call today's verdict justice because justice implies restoration, but it is accountability, which is a step towards justice. And so no, justice is in your hands." And when I say your hands, I mean the hands of the people of the United States. So he's definitely emphasizing that. He's happy that the murder conviction happened, but he just sees this as a first step. And Barack Obama making similar comments, where he says that true justice requires that we come to terms with the fact that black Americans are treated differently every day. Today's verdict may have been a necessary step on the road towards progress, but it was far from a sufficient one. We cannot rest. We need to follow through with concrete reforms that will reduce and ultimately eliminate racial bias in our criminal justice system. And so really kind of tipping his hand there that he's regardless of how they would have ruled in the George Floyd case, his primary concern is reforming the criminal justice system in the United States.
Yeah, this whole point that no matter what reforms are made, no matter what, say that this conviction against Derek Chauvin, they said if it doesn't go our way, we're going to burn the city down. They got what they wanted. They're not happy. The fact that whatever reforms are made are not going to pacify or appease them, that there's always going to be more, that there more demands, is a really powerful one. And you would think that there would be more people waking up to the fact that the more we engage with this this conversation on race that they keep insisting that we have, the more we go along with this narrative, the worse race relations grow, the more violent the mob becomes, the more insistent they become on getting their way regardless of the justice system that has been in place for 200 years in this country. There is no satisfying this group.
No, there's nothing. And you can see, because when you look at like the 21st Century Task Force on Policing that the Obama administration produced during his second term, you don't have to read between the lines too much to really see that the ultimate goal is to federalize and centralize all policing in America. And so once you understand that, you realize that no matter what reforms the local police make, it will never be enough, because the entire point is to abolish the concept of local policing. And so the local police can say, well, we'll convict this man for murder, and we'll fire this officer, and we'll fire this mayor, and we'll make these changes, and we'll make these changes, and we'll make these rule policy switches. But at the end of it, they don't want the local police to become less racist. They want the local police abolished so that they can be replaced with a new federal policing system. And so that's really gets to the heart of why nothing's ever good enough. And in his article, The Real Agenda Behind Black Lives Matter, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury even makes the point that that's really a strategy straight from the communist playbook, where in order to change a nation, you kind of with your left hand you stir up riots in the street, and then with your right hand you come in with bureaucrats in the upper echelons of federal government to propose authoritarian solutions to solve the problem of the riots. So it's a very classic. It's like you move in to solve a problem you created maneuver. And so when you actually see that that's what you're doing, it's like that they actually want race riots, not necessarily because they want to destroy the country for destroying the country's sake, but because it's a lever or it's a tool. If you're creating race riots as a crisis to get the political forms you want. But then, like I said, if you look at the biblical perspective there of just kind of this evil spiritual element behind that, you can see that the plan doesn't end up working. They're trying to like hold the nation to ransom in order to get what they want. But when that spirals out of control and people start burning and looting and large parts of the population think that there's a legitimate genocide against black people, you won't be able to put that genie back in the bottle again. Mm.
And this does point directly to prophecies that talk about the cities of America burning and racial problems really exploding into race war in this nation. It's really an important subject for our listeners to be up to speed on. That article from Gerald Fleury, The Real Agenda Behind Black Lives Matter, an important article. We also have an article going up from Stephen Fleury, Fanning the Flames of Hate, about these latest incidents this past week. And if you haven't been listening to the Trumpet Daily Show, please do so. Stephen Fleury's been covering this in detail, and it's really important to keep our eyes on just how much this destructive trend is exploding in the United States right now. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. Yesterday morning, a missile attack in Israel raised many questions about what's happening in Syria and about the effectiveness of Israel's famed missile defense system. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story because there's just so many details that we do not know about it, even 2 days on, which is pretty rare in terms of a missile penetrating Israel from one of its enemy states. And this missile was a S-200 missile. This comes from an anti-aircraft battery fired from Syria. It flew, it seems, about 300 kilometers all the way into southern Israel and perhaps landed about 30 kilometers from Dimona, which is just south of Beersheba. And this is Israel's nuclear site where it develops its nuclear weapons. And what's really interesting about this is that this missile was able to penetrate Israel's famed defensive missile shield. This is what Israel has spent the past 20 years developing, to the point that, you know, Hamas from Gaza or Hezbollah from Lebanon or even Hezbollah from or Iranian assets inside Syria can fire these missiles against Israel, and they're fired out of the sky every single time or close to it to about 90%, 95% success rate. And yet here we had one individual missile that was fired from Syria. We don't exactly know the cause of why it was fired from Syria. After it was fired, the Israeli military said that it took out the battery that sent the missile into Israeli territory. But we don't know why it got there and why it was able to evade, I guess, the defensive missile shield. It's interesting because it comes at the same time that we have Israel's attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. Natanz has been attacked a couple of times through different means by Israeli agents over the past 6 months. And Iran has come out and said that it is going to look to target in the future the Dimona site of Israel. Hezbollah has said for the past couple of years that they have the ability to have a GPS-guided missile and strike that facility. And so putting all this together, there's plenty of people saying, the Iranians are saying this was an attempted attack on Dimona, and they were rejoicing over it, even though it didn't hit the target. Look, we got through. Israel is saying that, no, this was just an errant fire by the Syrians using this DUD missile, which is basically it is an older style missile. If it misses its target, it'll just go on and drop somewhere and land somewhere in the future. And so somewhere down the line. And so that's what they're saying. And the Americans are saying that also. So again, this is a lot we don't know about this missile. A lot Israel doesn't know about this missile, but I imagine there's a lot of people in the IDF wondering right now, how did we just lat through a missile flying 300 kilometers into our territory, deep into the south of Israel, and get 30 kilometers away from our nuclear weapons developing facility? That's got to raise some questions.
Yeah, what do you make of this? I think the Israelis tend to feel fairly secure, given the Iron Dome, David's sling, the arrow. They have like three or four different layers of missile protection, and it has given them quite a lot of security in the face of a lot of missile attacks coming from Gaza. And we haven't seen this coming from Syria, but other locations that have tried to penetrate into Israel that have not been successful. What does this do to Israelis when they contemplate what just happened yesterday?
Well, I think there won't be too much disquiet among Israelis, given the success of the, as you mentioned, the Iron Dome, David Sling, the Arrow system, and also this, a Patriot missile was fired at this one, which is the U.S.-developed anti-missile system. I don't think they would be too concerned, but at least they need to ask. They will be asking some questions of how this missile got through. I think Israelis, when they think about how much money and effort and know-how and ingenuity has been put forward into these defense systems over the past decade and plus, they feel pretty confident that they will be able to take out most targets that are fired at them. However, I think it is worth, definitely, it should puncture Israel's feeling of invincibility of missile attacks. And if I'm Hezbollah right now, or if I'm the Iranians, I am rejoicing at this attack because it shows that you can get through. You can get through Israel's missile shield, and you can do it in some fashion like this. Maybe it was a mistake that the interception missed or whatever. That's what the IDF is saying. However, what happens when there is an actual all-out missile attack against Israel in the future? And we know the massive numbers that exist in Syria, with Hezbollah, in southern Lebanon, on the Gaza Strip, right now with Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and then the Houthis. That we can't forget them. There's two Iron Domes. There was an Iron Domes down in Eilat, in the southern port city of Eilat, because the Houthi rebels in northern Yemen, they have missiles that can reach all the way into Israeli territory. Daily, they are firing ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia. You just don't hear about it any longer because it happens so often. However, there is a massive missile threat against the state of Israel by Iranian proxies. All of these are Iranian proxies. And if I'm one of them, I'm rejoicing at the fact that you can get through. And if I'm Israeli, I'm really starting to wonder whether there isn't something more we can do than hedge our bet and put all our money into missile defense. And I think that's what God obviously is interested in. God is most interested in people looking to him for their defense. And the state of Israel has a massive history with God, even though they have taken up arms, of course, in the War of Independence and the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Those initial battles of Israel were backed backed by God, there was a lot of prayers that went up for the defense of the state of Israel, and they were miracle victories. However, I wonder how many Israelis come into 2021 recognizing their weakness. They did recognize their weakness in 67 and 48, and they had to rely on God to a certain point. But you just don't see that anymore because of this false sense of security that's been created by the defensive missile shield.
Where would you send people for more information about what you're speaking about?
I think, just like I'm going to talk about in the second half, the Jerusalem Prophecy book by Mr. Gerald Flurry is a great resource to look at the dangers of putting faith in military systems for your protection.
You know, I'm reminded also of the an article that Mr. Flurry wrote about the miracle victories in Israel's past. It was in the March 2008 edition, Israel, When the Miracle Victories Ended, when he talked about just the transition from relying on God to relying on a peace process and putting their faith in promises from the Arabs. And you definitely see that that change from really not looking to God the way that they did in the past when they enjoyed those victories. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. And we'll link to both of those in the show notes for the program today, Jerusalem and Prophecy and that Miracle Victories article from Gerald Flurry. German politics took an interesting turn this week as the nation's ruling party chose a deeply unpopular man as its candidate for elections next fall, and it really puts the country in uncharted political territory. To learn how, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it looks like the next few months of German politics could get pretty interesting. So, like we talked about, I think last week, you've had this conflict going on within Germany about who from Germany's right-wing parties is going to succeed Angela Merkel. So this Angela Merkel's bloc is an alliance of two right-wing parties, the CDU and the CSU. And which of their leaders would succeed Angela Merkel as their leading candidate? And on the one hand, you had Armin Laschet, who is a who's seen as very popular within the party, not hugely popular with the everyday German, and Markus Söder, who is from the Bavarian CSU, who is dramatically more popular. And Söder lost. So they've got now Armin Laschet has cemented his place as the top candidate for Angela Merkel's party. And then also this week, you had a poll that has really shaken Germany came out, and that put the Green Party as the single most popular party within Germany. Number one. So it shows potentially that Laschet's nomination could have lost the Christian Democratic Union a lot of popularity. And it means that we are in very interesting territory for German politics now.
So tell us about the Green Party and just how disruptive this is to the status quo in German politics.
Yeah, so the Greens, they have been in government before as a minor coalition party. You know, they are typically a good result for the Green Party in the past was 8%. So they're a minor party. There was a couple of terms in government where they formed a coalition with the SPD, the main German left-wing party, and they had a minor role in government. What we're seeing now is something very different. You know, it's quite going from that to now, they are Germany's main, most popular left-wing party in terms of the opinion poll. And their leader now, their chancellor candidate, Annalena Baerbock, she's been chosen very recently to be their candidate for chancellor. She's about the only person that I think has any real enthusiasm behind her. You know, there is a sense that she has a very left-wing vision for Germany. This is a vision for Germany that sees the internal combustion engine banned from the road by 2030. So it's a pretty radical vision, but it's a vision. And it's a passion, it's a belief, and that seems like she has generated some enthusiasm behind her. People are excited about this. So she seems about the only candidate that anyone is particularly excited about at the moment and is generating. Her party is the party with a lot of momentum. Now, there's still a long time to go before the elections. And one of the things when you have inexperienced parties like this shoot to the top, they tend to have maybe more skeletons in their closet because they haven't had that kind of closer scrutiny. So, you know, maybe they won't be able to maintain this level of popularity all the way through to the autumn. But certainly that is a very unique situation. And we also don't really know what type of a Green Party we would get if they do go into government. I mean, the Baerbock is kind of from the moderate wing of the Green Party, the side of the party that will compromise to get what she wants, who doesn't want to let good be the enemy of great, kind of thing. Okay, well, sure, we'll work with this government. It's not ideal, but if we can make it more environmental, we'll do it. This wing of the party also tends to emphasize more human rights and kind of standing up against Russia and China, which is why you're in this very unusual situation where the Green Party is talking about Germany spending more on its military. There is a different wing of the party, though. There is the kind of the more old-style Greens that grew up campaigning against American nuclear missiles in Europe, much more anti-American, much more hardline. So what do we get after the election? This is something that's a big open question. There's people talking about a CDU-Green coalition emerging after the election. There's also people talking about the potential of having a left party, Green Party, SDP coalition, which is literally a coalition of the communists and the Greens. And if that happens, you know, it's hard to imagine something more different from Angela Merkel. The left party is the descendant of the communist party that used to rule East Germany. So if you have all of these hard left parties get in, you know, you've gone from kind of stable, boring Angela Merkel to Bernie Sanders on steroids running Germany.
So from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, we've been talking about this kind of disruptive environment within German politics for quite some time, the dissatisfaction of a lot of German voters with the way that things have been operating for some time, and just how this paves the way for the kind of upheaval that we would expect given the prophecies of the Bible. Maybe you can just put this in that prophetic context for us.
Yes, and actually I'll start by pointing you to where to go to get more information, because I think it does tie into this prophetic context nicely. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had his Key of David program, his latest one that's just gone up on the website today, on this subject. And it's a great place to learn about what the Bible says on this. It's called The Beast That Was and Is Not and Yet Is, and it gives you an overview of what the Bible prophesies about this coming Holy Roman Empire that is going to rise in Europe. Now, in some ways, you know, he talks about how the Bible prophesies of this Holy Roman Empire, and the Greens, they are definitely a pro-European party. And in fact, Ambrose Evan Pritchard, writing about them this week, he called them the fer de lance of the Holy Roman Empire in its modern form, or the tip of the spear in the Holy Roman Empire in its modern form. They are the ones that really want to build Europe into a unified Holy Roman Empire. So perhaps they could play a role there. But one of the key points Mr. Flurry made in that piece, in that video, talking about the upcoming German election, is talking about this appetite within Germany for a strong leader and for somebody who's going to make these decisions. And really, you don't see any. If you're a German voter and you want a strong, decisive leader, there isn't really a way for you to vote for one. You know, Laschet, he was made fun of for his on Twitter by a lot of Germans for this idea of whenever there's a big decision needs to be made, he goes off and sits down and thinks for a few days. And Laschet's contemplations, Laschet Denken, became trending in German Twitter because of this. You know, there isn't a good way to get a strong leader through this system. So as times become worse, as you have potential crises and this appetite for a strong leader becomes more keen, well, then the only way to get that leader is to change the system, to come up with something very new, to maybe not bring in somebody through a democratic method. And that is exactly what we've been forecasting for Germany. There are prophecies that talk about a German strong leader coming in an unorthodox way. And so you could see how these events pave the way for that. But that Key of David is a great place to go more, the beast that was and is not and yet is. And then just on that prophecy about a strong leader coming to Germany, we have a free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that talks about that some more.
All right, outstanding. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Look forward to watching that Key of David program. Examples of Chinese authoritarianism arise with alarming frequency. The latest is a move right out of Stalinist Russia with a technological twist. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the Chinese Communist Party has launched a new app that allows citizens to report each other to the government for posting anything online that expresses any kind of dissent against the government or even just what they call mistaken opinions. So this app was launched by a branch of the Chinese government called the Cyberspace Administration of China. And in their statement about it, they said the app gives Chinese citizens, quote, an active role in identifying malicious people who are distorting facts and confusing others. And then it talks a little bit about how they hope to stamp out any sort of posts about distorted historic facts as well. So we know that in reality, the Chinese Communist Party is one of the world's worst offenders for distorting facts and for rewriting history. You know, all you have to do is ask one of the party members about something like the Tiananmen Square massacre or the history of the South China Sea or Xinjiang, and you'll get answers that are a perverse distortion of reality. But that distortion, those revisionist views are the only ones that China will countenance. It's the only thing they allow. And now, if anyone sees that another Chinese person has posted something online that questions the official narrative with any of those kinds of issues, they can just pull up their app or use a new website that was unveiled along with it, and they can have the offender flagged and very likely arrested. Another part of this announcement says, quote, we hope that the majority of internet users will actively play their part in supervising society and enthusiastically report harmful information, end quote. So just very Orwellian. They want to weaponize the Chinese people against each other in order to prevent anyone from criticizing Chinese President Xi Jinping or other parts of the government or government policies. And the Cyberspace Administration statement did not detail what the punishment would be for those who are reported for violations. But earlier this year, Chinese lawmakers amended the Constitution to stipulate that anyone who insults the memory of Communist Party heroes may be imprisoned for up to 3 years. So we know that it doesn't take much at all to run afoul of the Chinese Communist Party, and the punishments for that can be very severe.
You know, I spoke with Dr. Dana Chang on the Trumpet Hour on Wednesday, and she was just talking about how much the Chinese Communist Party uses those Marxist tools of divide and conquer, basically, to accomplish its aims. And this pitting Chinese people against other Chinese people, really, this is right out of... It's the same tactics that you saw within the Soviet Union, and this has also been used to hurt China itself in its history as well.
That's right, yes. We have. If you look at the Soviet Union, citizens there were taught that the surest way to show yourself a loyal supporter of Joseph Stalin and the surest way to protect yourself from government persecution would be to inform authorities about individuals who questioned Stalin or murmured against him or even told an off-color joke about him. You know, friends, neighbors, even members of your own family could report on you. And it very often happened, especially with young people. They would report their parents for what they called subversive behavior. Between 1928, when Stalin seized power, and his death in 1953, there were 25 million Soviet citizens who were either executed or worked to death as a punishment for disloyalty. And that figure is about 1/8 of the total population. And it was made up largely of people arrested after informers had ratted them out. So just very chilling history there. And of course, as you said, China has its own recent history of weaponizing its population against itself. Mao Zedong, in 1966, he implemented what was called the Red Guards. This was armies of people between 14 and 21 years old, both male and female. And Their number one purpose was to find potential enemies of communism, both within the party and in the general population. They started off targeting intellectuals, but that was just the start. And soon the violence just spiraled well beyond the intelligentsia. Soon anyone could be targeted. Many people were buried alive. Many were even cannibalized. And by the time of Mao's death in 1976, this cultural revolution, he called it, had killed between 1 and 2 million people. So just astounding. The number of those persecuted is believed to be well north of 10 million, including the father of Xi Jinping, who was publicly beaten and exiled. But, you know, that history apparently doesn't sour President Xi's view of Mao Zedong, because he has really enshrined Mao as the most respected figure in the communist pantheon. And Xi, of course, even mirrors many of Mao's methods, such as this new campaign to give Chinese citizens this active role in exposing and punishing critics of the party.
Well, the evidence of what we're dealing with China just continues to mount. Jeremiah has written an article about this specific situation here in China, and it points to an article from Gerald Fleury back in February 2020 about the climax of man's rule over man and the Bible's prophecies of a times of the Gentiles, a period where Gentile powers like China will rise ascendant over the earth, and it will be a time of great suffering. And you can see with the kind of powers that the government over there is taking to itself, just how big of a problem this will be for humanity when this is the governing power. The times of the Gentiles is an important prophecy to look at, the climax of man's rule over man. This article from Gerald Fleury. Take a look at that and keep your eyes peeled for Jeremiah's article about this new app that China has just unleashed. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, violence playing out in the streets of Jerusalem, the end of the rule of the Castros in Cuba, and Germany's effort to combat COVID by centralizing its power. We're also going to hear a warning to Americans from Donald Trump. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Fresh violence is filling the streets in Jerusalem. To learn why, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Yes, this is kind of rare. It hasn't really happened for a few years where you've had violence in the streets of Jerusalem. And for the past few nights, really culminating last night, there has been Arab against Jew, Jew against Arab violence specifically. Normally, in the times of the past, going back to 2015, you had the lone wolf attacks that were happening inside Jerusalem with knife assailants and car rammings, things of that nature, by Arab assailants against Israelis. And what we've seen over the past 3 days is mobs of Jewish, mainly youth, taking to the streets of Jerusalem, chanting slogans. I'll give you an example of a couple of these slogans they're chanting. Long live Israel, Arabs get out, and sometimes even death to Arabs. And then you have Ramadan taking place right now. And so you have, once night falls as well, the Arab street kind of comes alive also. And so just on Thursday night, some 20 officers were wounded in clashes with both groups. There were 50 people arrested, 105 Arabs apparently were injured, including 22 that required hospitalizations. There was a number of Jews that were seriously injured as well. And what kind of precipitated the violence is, or the onset of the angry Jewish youth coming out on the street, and youth, I would put that term, you know, late teens and upwards in their early 20s, was a couple of videos that were shared on social media, which showed random acts of violence against Orthodox Jews taking place in Jerusalem. One of them just being on the light rail here, which travels basically down the border of East and West Jerusalem, even though there's no border, but technically where East and West Jerusalem divides. And a Arab going up to a male, a man, Orthodox man, slapping him across the face. and then just sending that out through social media, and then it got spread and spread and spread and spread. And then there was this counter-Jewish movement that said, enough's enough, we're not going to be threatened in our own city. And so they're marching around the streets, trying to find Arabs in some cases, and then inflicting violence on them. Now, in this case, most of the violence that happened last night was because of Jews trying to push to where the Arabs were and the police stopping them, Arabs trying to push to where the Jews were and the police stopping them. So there wasn't as much Arab on Jew violence or Jew on Arab violence, apart from the police getting involved to try and break these sides apart, or keep these sides from actually coming together.
The timing of this is interesting. I guess the we saw the Abraham Accords under President Trump. Now we're back to a hard return to the kind of status quo treatment of the Palestinians, the Biden administration restoring aid to the Palestinians. We would expect a return to the status quo of this kind of violence in Jerusalem. I don't know if this is a direct cause or if that directly caused what we're seeing here, but you can see these kinds of headlines coming up more in the future, I would suspect.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think there's direct causation here between the two. Between the Jews, the slapping of the face and social media spread, and then Jews revolting against that, saying that not in our city. However, the United States government right now does intend, it seems, to play a larger role with the Palestinians and Israelis, leading towards, as they would say, some type of peace deal. But what we know from the Biden administration is that they're heavily favoring the Palestinians already. Just today, they released a statement. The U.S. Embassy in Israel did, that said this, quote, "We're deeply concerned about the incidents of violence in Jerusalem over the last several days. We hope all responsible voices will promote an end to incitement, a return to calm and respect for the safety and dignity of everyone in Jerusalem." Now, such a statement seems pretty innocuous, but the U.S. Embassy doesn't normally weigh in ever on this type of thing. And so releasing this statement when they don't even have an ambassador right now, it's like, who wrote this? and so it is interesting to see, as Biden puts the focus back on the Palestinians, the embassy in Jerusalem getting involved, inserting itself, calling for calm, that we can foresee the Biden administration playing up violence like this, and coming harder down on the side of Israel. They've already said they want to condition aid to their allies in the Middle East based on human rights. And they've already come out and said that they disagree with Israel's what they're doing in the West Bank against the Palestinians. And so when violence does start up in Jerusalem, we can expect the Biden administration to tilt very much firmly in the Palestinian side. People want to understand more about what violence does precurse in Jerusalem. I recommend they read Jerusalem About to Explode, the third chapter of Jerusalem Prophecy.
Thank you very much, Brent. The end of the rule of the Castros in Cuba could open the door for international maneuvering to get into this nation on America's back door. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah and Jacques.
Yeah, we know the winds of change are blowing through Cuba right now. This week we saw the end of the historic Castro era. They had been leading the country for more than 60 years, and Raul Castro stepped down, so that was a big change. But one thing that clearly has not changed is Russia's determination to deepen its influence in Cuba. On Tuesday, just one day after Castro stepped down, Russian President Vladimir Putin made a phone call to the new leader, Miguel Diaz-Canel. Canel is now the first secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba. That's the most powerful position in the one-party state. And we don't know many details about what Putin and Diaz-Canel discussed, but they did release a statement after the call that said the two are determined to strengthen the strategic partnership between their nations. So those two countries were already quite close. The Castros were aligned with Russia both during the Soviet era and also after the Soviet collapse. And now it looks like Putin is doing what he can to draw Cuba under its new leader even deeper into the Russian orbit.
You mentioned Russia's history in trying to get into Cuba. That's very well known. It's Cuba isn't the only South American, Latin American nation that it has tried to establish a presence in.
That's right. Yes, Russia has been deepening ties, you know, as we've been talking about with Cuba, but also they've set their sights on Venezuela, really built a lot of military clout in that country by helping to support the regime of Maduro. And then the other big one for Russia in Latin America is Nicaragua. Over the last few years, Russia has sold Nicaragua so many tanks and patrol boats and other kinds of armaments that at present, it's estimated that 90% of all Nicaragua's weapons imports are now from Russia. So there really is a pattern here, an undeniable pattern that Russia has emerged in Latin America, especially in these three countries. And when you look at that in light of Bible prophecy, it really shows that this is something to keep a close eye on. We know that prophecy talks about a time in the future when the United States will be besieged. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about this future besiegement, especially in his booklet Isaiah's End Time Vision. And he explains that it will happen at the hands of a European power that is working in conjunction with Russia and China. Mr. Fleury has pointed to prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 that talk about a mart of nations. These are describing cooperation between Europe and Russia and China, and it shows that they'll eventually come to dominate world trade, and they'll operate in a way that blocks the U.S. out of world trade. So with that in mind, when you look at these three nations that we've been talking about, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, they really surround the Caribbean Sea, which is vital to U.S. security. You know, this sea not only connects the East Coast with the Pacific Ocean via the Panama Canal, but it also guards the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico. Half of America's seaborne trade passes through that. So if a foreign power came to control the Caribbean Sea, then that could really cripple the U.S. economy. And to see Russia getting more and more of a foothold there in those three nations, it's easy to see how that is creating the conditions for that prophesied siege to take place.
Well, we have an article about that very prophecy by Jeremiah Jacques and Andrew Miller, Preparing to Storm America's Castle. It was printed in our March 2019 edition, and we will link to that in the show notes for the program. Go check that out to learn more about why it's important for America to be protective of this vital area to its south, and why Russia is seeking influence there. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. A new law in Germany to address COVID increases the power of the central government. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany passed their Infection Protection Act this week, and this takes power to enforce the lockdowns in Germany away from the federal states and centralizes it in the government. You could compare Germany's COVID response to the United States, where in many cases it's state officials that have been determining lockdown policy, if there's a curfew, if there is a curfew, what time that curfew kicks in, all of that on a state-by-state basis. These governors, the German states, they don't have as much freedom as the American states do, but there's been a lot of flexibility. What this does is centralizes that all with the government, and there's a set system now so that if case rates reach a specific level in each state, certain measures automatically kick in. You have 100 cases per 100,000, you are into curfews. You have 150 cases per 100,000, businesses have to close. So it's not that that's necessarily every state will be doing the same thing, but there's a unified approach all across Germany. But the reason why a lot of people are drawing attention to this is that's a pretty big constitutional change. I mean, it would be in the United States if the president suddenly grabbed the power to dictate the response to COVID and took it away from the states. Germany's most popular newspaper, Bild, referred to it as a black hour for freedom. And this is especially concerning, I think, in Germany, where this federal system has been set up for a reason. America helped write Germany's constitution, its basic law, and it's designed to try and make sure you don't get an Adolf Hitler type person, you know, to limit the power of the central state. And here, without very much opposition at all, this was undone. Now, this is being challenged in the German Constitutional Court, so perhaps it might be ruled unconstitutional and overturned. The only real opposition to this came from the Green Party, and their big concern was it didn't go far enough, and they actually wanted more power centralized.
So where would you send people for more understanding about why this is so concerning within Germany in particular?
Well, I point back to that that book. I think A Strong German Leader is Imminent. You know, we've been talking about a strong leader coming to power in Germany, and for that to happen, you would need some of these constitutional norms and some of these different restraints that have been put in place within Germany to prevent a strong leader, or at least a too strong leader coming into power, to have to be weakened. Now, this particular thing for coronavirus is time limited, but once you start making cracks in your constitution, you know, you weaken it as a whole. So in doing this, you can really see it setting the stage for the arrival of a strong leader. And that book will take you and show you how a strong leader was prophesied in scriptures, chapters like Daniel 11, Daniel chapter 8, that these are prophecies that apply to the modern era, and that what we're seeing happen in Germany is exactly what your Bible has been forecasting.
It seems, too, like Gerald Fleury has spoken about just how much European governments are using coronavirus as a means of consolidating their power. I'm reminded of his article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, where he was talking specifically about just this disease being used as a pretext for consolidating power. That we'll also link to that in our show notes for the program today. And thank you for that, Richard. One last story. Donald Trump gave his first sit-down interview since leaving the White House. He focused attention on a problem he said could destroy the country. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, and it was about an hour-long interview, and Mr. Trump covered a lot of different topics. But probably the one that caught the most headlines and the thing he said towards the beginning of the interview is just how horrible the current border crisis is and what potential it has to even destroy the country. He told Sean Hannity that the clock is ticking for America. There, meaning the Democrats, are playing it down as much as they can play it down. But it's a horrible situation, could destroy our country. People are pouring in, and you'll see something as the months go by like you've never seen before. Already it's like you've never seen before. There's never been anything like this happen at our border. People are coming in by the tens of thousands. So he went on and talked about that for a little bit, but then you just keep looking at the statistics, and I think last month there were 172,000 people apprehended at the border, so that's more than any month in 20 years, and it looks like this month, April, may be on par to exceed even that. And so President Trump really highlighted just the fact of like the drugs coming in with them, the drug cartels coming in with them, the criminals coming in with them, even like potential terrorists coming in with them, and what a national security threat that is. But there have been others who've even pointed out. I saw an interview even with Ken Paxton, who's the Attorney General for Texas, saying that like really the only reason the Biden administration would allow this to happen is a campaign to turn Texas blue. Like basically, if you let in enough illegal immigrants and then give them a path to amnesty, or even don't give them a path to amnesty, just don't require voter IDs and let them vote, eventually you'll see Texas voting as a blue state, in which case with both Texas and California, the Electoral College would be tipped so far towards the Democrats that a Republican really would never have a chance to win again. And that's really what Trump's trying to what I think Trump was trying to get at when he says like the clock's ticking for America. We've got like 2 to 4 years to fix this. Otherwise, there's just not a chance for another constitutional conservative to be running the United States.
And what's the view of Bible prophecy of this?
Yeah, the article we'll put in the show notes is from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that's titled Why I Still Believe Donald Trump is Coming Back. And in that article, he really goes through a prophecy in Amos, set in the time span of the ancient Israelite king Jeroboam, and he's identified Donald Trump as a type of the ancient Israelite king Jeroboam in other articles. But the verse he focuses on is Amos 7 and 8, and it says, "And the Lord said unto Amos, what do you see?" And he said, "I see a plumb line. Then said the Lord, behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not pass by them again anymore." And in the article, this is his commentary on that verse. He says, "We have been watching this prophecy since June 1990 in the second issue of The Trumpet we've ever produced. It speaks of a time when God is preparing to measure the destruction of end-time Israel, the United States, and Britain. And he says, I will not pass by them anymore. This is just before severe correction comes on these nations if they don't repent. They're receiving their final warning." So the whole context of God saying, I will not pass by them again anymore in the time of Jeroboam, an end-time antitype of King Jeroboam II of Israel. And like I mentioned, so he's identified this end-time antitype as Donald Trump, saying that God's not going to pass by them anymore. And so that some of these horrible things that Donald Trump's talking about destroying the country, are going to happen, but not just yet.
Not when he's not in power. Right. It'll be during his time in power. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. You can watch for that article, Why I Still Believe Donald Trump is Coming Back. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. And Andrew has an article, Donald Trump, Border Crisis is Horrible Situation That Could Destroy America. That'll be up on the website soon if it's not there already. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Dwight Eisenhower. Freedom has its life in the hearts, the actions, the spirit of men, and so it must be daily earned and refreshed, else like a flower cut off from its life-giving roots, it will wither and die. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.